Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Line Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been and it always will be.
Welcome to White Line Fever. My name is Steve Mascor. This is the start of this show, but it is the third part of our interview with Gary Moat here from Burnout Rec. I want to thank him for his time. Welcome back, Gary. There's a movie out at the moment about Eurovision, and everyone's talking about it. I haven't seen it, but you guys have some history with Eurovision. Can you talk us through it a little bit? Well, tell the listeners the story.
The half day. Eurovision. It's very simple, you know. It's like when you get all this money from record companies in the '80s, and you're not selling mega. Shifting mega units, like, you know, because you haven't had any really big hit singles, you know, it's not as if we were like Bon Jovi or something, you know, every song was a big hit single, you know, and we didn't co-write with anybody, and that's what Bon Jovi did,
yep.
You know, that was why they had so many hits at the time, you know, using the top people. So come Eurovision, you know, the record company, we'd been there, done the three albums, and we were in the middle of at the end of doing my third album, The Big Bang, and they decided that you could go on Eurovision because, you know, they're opening that up to rock bands now, and they thought, you know, if you can get on there, you'll be out there and promote one song, and hopefully it'll sell thousands of copies, because you're playing to millions of people in Eurovision right across Europe, you know, it's just... And so that was the idea behind it, yeah. Obviously, you know, at the time, a lot of people thought we were off our heads, really, for going and doing it, you know, and we got slated for it, you know, and,
Dude, I just wondered, mate, like now, when you play these gigs and you go to Hard Rock Hell and stuff, and, you know, on one hand, you think of yourself as a working musician and, you know, and rock is not in the mainstream anymore. But on the other hand, you know, we have people come up to you and say amazing things. I mean, I remember your album covers like I remember Bon Jovi, and you know the band was named after a album by UFO. But I saw your album cover before I saw UFO. You know what I mean? So how do you reconcile it, mate? Do you feel is it still quite magic for you that you had such an impact on a lot of people's lives or is it kind of like it's just a job, it's fun, it's a job, you're a working musician and you kind of over all that stuff? How do you kind of process it?
Oh, I mean, these days, back in the day in the 80s, it was great. You had people your own age running up to you and saying how the show about the band, and you were that drunk at the time, it didn't really make any difference to you. you just laughed along with them and had a good time, you know, and you appreciated the comments. But now that I'm out there doing it and people talk to me, I mean, we talk to everybody, we get involved with the crowd after the gig and stuff. There's no hiding away or anything, and acting like rock stars, this is the real world we live in, you know.
Yeah.
And we get involved, and when people say to me about the past now, you know, I mean, it really makes me very emotional, you know, and it's just great to hear what they're saying, and you just think, I have never viewed myself as being, you know, some sort of rock star-y kind of figure to people, but obviously we must have been, Heavy Petting must have been, you know, and I never really think about that. I never thought about that back in the day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I get it all the time. It's like, you know, drummers, you know, oh, man, you look, you were that. And I'm like, was I? I thought I was fluffing it at the time, you know. It's taking me all my time just to play some drum films, you know. And they're thinking it was the best thing they've heard. And it's just great. And people talking about the songs and what it meant to them, you know, and it's great, you know. But
you must miss that interaction now, like you know, the lockdown and COVID-19. It must be a, you know, just all the people and the dark rooms and the beer and the lights and the, yeah.
We love to play live, you know. I love getting out there, standing up in front of the stage and screaming my tits off, you know, and, you know, everybody just looking and you're just thinking, what's he on, you know? well, actually, I'm on nothing because I'm sober because I drive the van, you know? You know, and so I don't even believe myself that I'm out there doing that sober, you know, because I never played drums sober in my life, you know? It's terrible.
Mate, that's a great way to finish the interview. I really appreciate your time. Just one more song, Gary. What can we play?
Can you play Swallow from the first Bon Iver album?
Oh!
and you're listening to White Line Fever.
Okay, final bit of our interview here with Donny V, and want to thank him for his time. This is the fun bit, because this is where the readers and the fans submitted questions on Facebook. Okay, so Chris Lachlan says, a new thing is a belter of a song. Good Aussie word there, a belter. Or actually an English word as well. Do you ever get bored of singing it?
Oh, never, no. I sing it in my spare time all the time. I'll just sit around, pick up the guitar, and start singing new things. Thanks, Chris, by the way. It is a pretty cool song, and I remember how it struck me the first time I heard it finished, or the first time that the idea came to my head for the song, and I remember how cool that was. It was like, holy shit, this is really cool. You know, but it's a long time ago, and I've written so many more since then that are really cool, and that I haven't sang 150,000 times. You know what I mean?
Wow. Next question is
but
from David.
Thank you, Chris.
Next question.
I think it's a cool song too.
David Donaldson says, "How did you guys hook up with Derek and Vic? Did Gino bail, and you had to find a replacement?"
It was through a early management that we had, that was a bad experience, but through that is where Derek came in. Vic, it was just a trial and error with different guys coming in the revolving door until one stuck, and he stuck. You know, he's very professional and had the look and did his job very well, and that's kind of what we were, once Derek was in, that's kind of what we were looking for, you know what I mean? And that's how I came into it. You know, it's kind of like, it's sort of found myself in that position where there was my guitar player and my drummer. I really, it's not that I went out and seeked those guys out. It's just the way that things worked out. And that just became my drummer and guitar player.
Fantastic. And Renee Scroggin says, do you favor piano or guitar?
You just broke up. Do I favor playing the piano or the guitar?
Yeah.
I can't.
That's a question.
Actually, yeah. Neither. Because I suck on both. I suck on both.
It's a good answer. Okay. Zach.
I'm good at playing the fool.
Zach says, any plans to tour Australia?
That's one of my wishes. I want to come there. I've never been to Australia yet, and I'd really like to come. And I've had some amazing fans from Australia, and they keep in touch. It's a beautiful place, and I've always really wanted to go there and do it. And we talked about it last year, but then the pandemic hit. And so, I don't know. Just like everything else, it's up in the air, you know. But I would love to come.
Jay says, is the guitar that you're playing in right by your side the same one Diana just got back for you?
I do believe I had Derek playing it for Right By Your Side in the video. It's the same one, but I had him play it because I didn't want to see any more of these Kramer cock rock guitars and shit in my videos, you know? So I said, here, play the Les Paul. This looks cool. This looks cool. It makes you look cool. You know what I mean? And it did, but yeah, it's the same one.
Last question from Ben Fogarty. He wanted to talk about the magic in the studio during the recording of the album Strength. What was it like in the studio? Was there anything special? And he's also curious about your thoughts on Oasis, given the kind of things that the two bands had in common. They're different as well, but they had things in common. So there, two questions in one. And that's it.
Oasis. I love Oasis. I love Oasis. I think they're fantastic. I love the guy's voice, the songs, everything. What they did is right down the strike zone of the kind of shit that I like and grew up liking. So yeah, they're fantastic. And what was the other part of that question?
He said he thought that he on the album Strength, he said he heard magic. He wanted you to take him inside the studio.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, the most magical thing about it is we finally were out of our hometown, and we made that record out in L.A. and all of the craziness. And at that time, we were pretty special things. So there was a lot of debauchery and a lot of fun going on around us while making that record. And And we also had a, I had a chance to work with a really good producer, Paul Landy, and we got to really sit there and explore the songs more, which is really appeals to me than just plugging in with a couple of guitars, you know, and banging out another version of the first record. I liked that, taking it to the next level. And there was a lot of magical things in there. I played instruments I've never even seen before in that thing. And a lot of people still tell me that, you know, how great they think that record is. But every time I go into the studio, something, I see things that, I witness things that, that are as closest thing to magic as I as you ever could imagine, the way certain things just all of a sudden click and gel. And it's like, wow, it's like abracadabra. You know, that's just that right one thing or this right thing just completed it. And all of a sudden it just, it took form, you know what I mean? And, you know, because all these songs, they don't start out like that. They start out as an idea. And when they finally, and you record it and you record it and you record it and you're playing the instruments and this and that, and you're like, it's work. All of a sudden one, something will hit, something will trigger, and bam-o, there it is. It's like, oh man, that's so great. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've kept you for quite a while there, Donnie, and I really appreciate your time, and thanks for putting up with the technical problems. I just wanted to, last year was pretty terrible for everybody, I guess, but it sounds like for you it was, there were some positives out of the last 12 months. Is that right?
Yeah, last year was, as far as I'm concerned, was great. I hate to say that, though, but it didn't really damper on anything that I was doing. And, you know, I mean, I'm a homebody. I love to just be recording and writing and doing like normal things now that I've never got a chance to do, you know, like being part of a family and the best that I'm capable of being. And so it really didn't affect my lifestyle. If anything, it brought people closer together as far as I was concerned in my life, you know?
Yeah, and is it, so what's next?
I'm not the biggest fan of touring anyway.
So I've read. What's the next big thing for you, Donnie? Like, what would you like people to know to know about? If there's one thing you'd like people to be aware of, what is it?
This next song and video, I'd like to a lot of aware. I believe that if enough people hear it, I believe that this one has a chance to do something and be a game changer, or not. You know, I mean, hope is a dangerous thing. You know what I mean? When you have hope, you know, the flip side of hope is shattered dreams. So I'm cautious about hoping for anything or any expectations, but that's what I would like to happen. I don't really ask for much in the world. I don't want to be rich and famous. I like to make things, paint pretty colors across the sky that people can listen to and give people something to enjoy. And that gives me enjoyment. And this would maybe give me an opportunity to reach more people through that song. We'd listen to other stuff that I did and realize that, you know, there's something there for them.
Yeah. Well, I think everyone watching, you know, believes that you deserve that audience and you deserve that exposure. Let's hope the strategy's right and it reaches as many ears as possible. We'll finish up with for the listeners and one more song.
I don't know if I deserve it. I do know the songs deserve it.
Yeah, yeah. How do they come to you?
One new song.
How does a new song come to you? Yeah, many different ways, or is it one way?
The simplest way to say that is, God beams it into my head and then it's time to go to work. Most of them are not inspired by, they're inspired by this thing that's presented to me in my head. When I hear it, I know this is the next thing I'm supposed to be doing. And it's just a relationship I've had with God or whatever is out there that works with me or through me. For so many years, I don't think twice about it anymore. I know, okay, I get the message and I get to work. And, you know, it just gets a little more difficult as after all these songs and years to keep trying to find some way to make it new, make something newer than what I've done before, you know, because you get bored with all of that, you know, doing the same old thing, you know, same, another great song, another great song, another great song. It just, it, you know, I mean, it's like the best pizza in the world, you know, after enough slices, you know, it's like, okay, I've had enough of that. You know, I try something else, you know? And so, but it, there's never any question that of how this works with me. It's hard for people to understand, but it is the case. Something is working through me.
Did you ever worry that it had dried up, that it had stopped? Have you ever worried about that?
It had for a couple of years. I just drained myself and beat myself up, and just life had beaten me up so badly that that whole frame of spirituality and stuff just disappeared out of my life, and it just became dark and ugly and lonely. And and then, you know, I did a lot of praying, and you know, a few circumstances came to be that put me in a position of where I was on the right track to fixing a lot of those things. And throughout that time where I had to just focus on nothing but my physical aspects, my health, my mental health, things like that, not one song idea came to me, nothing. I hadn't picked out in here. And then when I got to the point where I felt alive again, I felt better, and I felt like, okay, now what? You know, are we going to do this again? And instantly my question was answered, and the Beautiful Things record just came pounding at me one after another, all those songs, and got to work.
Fantastic story. Fantastic story. What song can we finish up with for the listeners there, Donnie?
I guess I could Save the World. Let's go with that one.
We used to have Led Zeppelin, Stones, and Beatles. Hooking up with girlfriends face to face. I realized my country by an eagle flying higher, stronger and free. But now it's all another place. And all I
to me, I could
I'm Donnie V, and you are listening to White Line Fever with my favorite host, Steve.
Welcome back. And we've got a fellow who has been on the show once before. I won't bore him by trying to remind him when it was, but they've got a new album out coming out soon called All the Right Noises at the end of the month. From Thunder, please welcome Luke Morley. Hello, Luke. How are you, mate?
I'm fine, Steve. Considering that this ungodly hour, I don't feel too bad. We're good. I'm good.
That's good. Now, mate, I'm sure you do quite a lot of interviews where, you know, the person asking you the question pretends to have heard the record and they've actually not listened to it all. And I think I've been guilty of that myself in the past. But that I'm not guilty of it at all on this occasion. So much so, I'm actually obsessed with some of the songs and some of the themes. It's one of the most topical records, maybe the most topical record the band's, you know, ever done. I won't start with Last One Out because that's one of the few songs we can play at this juncture. So I'll ask you about that last. But I'm really fascinated with the song Young Man, and I found myself asking myself if I would trade, part of my life to have to live through what kids are living through now. And the argument here is that you wouldn't go back if you could. That's a big call. Can you just talk about that song and about the feelings behind it, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, really, I suppose it's kind of like, it's like the opposite of my generation, hope I die before I get old, isn't it? But I think it's if you look at the world how it is now and how difficult it is for young people, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, you could make mistakes, you could get things wrong, you could get drunk, you could do silly stuff and get yourself into a little bit of trouble, and, you know, you'd make mistakes and you'd learn and you move on. Now, because we live in the age of the camera phone and the iPad, everything you do is recorded and witnessed, and 5 minutes later it's up there on the web. So, you know, the degree to which young people have to watch themselves now and think about all their actions, it's fairly scary. And I'm glad that, you know, I mean, particularly being in a band, my God, I mean, some of the shenanigans we got up to in our early days, I mean, blimey, if there'd have been camera phones, we'd all be in court now, probably. But, you know, I think that it's just, there's a lot of pressure on young people now to look perfect, to, you know, to be kind of, to externalize everything emotionally. And yeah, I don't think that's particularly necessarily healthy. So, and I guess the other point the song's making is that, you know, I grew up I was born in 60. So in the 70s, when I was a teenager, there was so much fantastic music and there was a kind of innocence and a lack of awareness about, you know, the world as a global thing. But now it's all on you if you're young. I mean, there are the pluses, you know, the stuff, well, before COVID, travel and stuff, all those things are easier. But just in terms of your privacy and your ability to develop as an individual, I think, you know, the world is very invasive now, and that must be hard for young people sometimes.
Yeah, but still, like, it's terrible now. I'm the same as you as far as I'd hate to live in the Instagram, you know, era. But still, if you said, here's an extra 30 years, you know what I mean? I might be willing to trade, you know? So,
It's about quality of the life, though, isn't it? I mean, if your life is great and fun and you're enjoying every day and brilliant, but if you're not and you're miserable, you know, I mean.
Yeah. I'm also obviously interested in St. George. I mean, that is a huge topic, right? You could talk about that for 15 minutes alone.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But I'm also interested in St. George's Day as well because, you know, it's an anti-Brexit song, really, isn't it? I mean, and this was not written in COVID times. The album, people probably aren't aware, is written pre-COVID and post-Brexit. I'll ask you just about that, about St. George's Day and the sentiment behind it, and then I've probably got a follow-up question to that.
Well, St. George's Day really is, it's about what it means to be English in the 21st century. And, you know, we're an island race, and there's always that kind of underlying thing that, you know, if things, you know, go wrong, we can pull up the drawbridge and carry on. But we live in a global world. That's not possible now. It's really, really not possible. I mean, COVID, the interesting thing about COVID is it's made us question border control, but for different reasons. Prior to COVID, it was like, you know, there's a kind of unhealthy kind of undercurrent in the UK of, well, the immigrants are coming here and stealing all our jobs, which is just patently is not true. And it's sort of, you know, right-wing dogma. And I'm not a fan of that. I think that, you know, if we've learned anything, or, you know, in the world, it's just, you've got to embrace it. You've got to kind of reach out to people, and you've got to connect with people rather than being suspicious and wary. You know, I mean, there's always going to be bad people everywhere. There's bad people in England. There's bad people in Australia. There's bad people everywhere in the world. But it doesn't. It's not an excuse to kind of pull up the drawbridge and blame everything on people who are different to you. You know, I mean, in the UK, this is the great ludicrousness of this point of view of the kind of, you know, the extreme right wing thing, is that most of England now is built on immigrants. I mean, you know, it really is. You know, all of the kind of really important jobs, healthcare, you know, after COVID and all of this stuff, these are people that have all come from other countries. So to kind of suddenly blame them for everything seems a bit wrong to me. And in the song uses the St. George's flag as a kind of metaphor, really, because that's been misappropriated by football hooligans, once again, more extreme right wing kind of groups. And it's something that I feel very strongly about. You know, we're supposed to be an open and civilized country, and that's what I would like us to be.
There is that line, and I read your only respect to you without any notes, and I only listened to it last night. But if you go back far enough, we all came from another place. Draw a line in the sand, cut off your nose to spite your face. But the interesting thing is that I'm guessing that it's same as many musicians have found in the last few years, is that the alienating part of their fan base is the very people they're criticising in their art. And I guess it's the same for people who are painters or writers or whatever, yeah. You know. How do you confront that reality?
Well, there's not much I can do about it. I mean, I think people are always going to have opinions, and you know, my job isn't to sort of, try and change people's minds. Just to say, I think part of the creative thing is when you're writing, whether it's music, film, books, whatever it is to say, hey, you know, you're not convincing if you don't say what you mean, you know, and you have to kind of sometimes wear your heart on your sleeve. And you know, when you get to my age, when you get to 60, and you know, and you're in a rock and roll band, you know, I've written all the songs about chasing girls I can manage. So, you know, and that's not what concerns me. I'm married, you know.
Other things
concern me now, and I'm going to write about them. And some people might not agree, but unfortunately, there's nothing I can do about that.
Okay, so as I said to you, Luke, the one song we can play now because it's out is Last One Out. Yeah. So that was a kind of, again, an anti-Brexit song. But if I didn't know it was written before COVID, I would say it was addressing the government's what is, you know, you obviously believe is bungled. Well, if I thought that you'd just written it, I would say that you believe they've bungled COVID and you've written a song about that. So in introducing the song, can you discuss it a little bit and tell us what its origins are?
Yeah. I mean, Last One Out is really, it's about the way the government handled the whole Brexit thing and the lying, the cronyism, basically the corrupt way they went about trying to kind of convince people it was the right thing to do. And also there was lots of playing on what I was just talking about in the last answer. There's lots of stirring up about, you know, oh, if we stay in the EU, there's going to be 8 million Turkish immigrants coming next month. They're going to, you know, all of that stuff was going on. So we were basically being lied to and manipulated. You know, there's some people in the government are extremely dishonest. I'm sure there's good people in there somewhere. But the messages that were coming out were extremely, they were trying to worry people. It's the same old thing. You know, keep people scared, keep them afraid, and you can get them to do what you want. And there's a lot of that going on with Brexit. And to me, you know, we spent 50 years as part of Europe, you know, and during that 50 years, you know, we're tweaking the rules, kind of, you know, lots of negotiation going on and you know, kind of adapting as we go and finding out new stuff. And to suddenly come along with just a razor blade and cut that off without any kind of subtlety of negotiation or just seems ludicrous to me. It set us back 50 years. You know, the thing about not being able to cross borders in Europe and for musicians, it's a bad thing. Every way you look at it, it's awful. So, and the song is basically me saying, you know, if it gets much worse, I'm off.
Plenty of people who voted for it have then now decided they're going to go live in Spain, or it's just ridiculous.
The ludicrous. I mean, there were people, British expats living in Spain who voted for it.
Welcome back to the program. Makes no sense to those of you who are watching, but for those listening, it does. Joel Hoekstra is back from Whitesnake and other projects as well, and he's got a new album. By the time you hear this, it'll be out, called Running Games. Joel, how would you describe the difference between the first and second 13 albums?
I would say that it's just a little more focused this time around. Dying to Live was something that I kind of learned what it was going to be as I was writing it. So it started out really heavy, and then it ended up being something that I signed with Frontiers, and, you know, it just kind of gravitated towards the more melodic thing as I went. So this time around, I pretty much had defined, I think, the core sound of it. So just a little bit more focused.
Yeah, yeah, and for those who don't know, it's an all-star band. You know, you've got Russell Allen, Tony Franklin, Vinnie Appice, Derek Sherinian. Joel, I think I kind of might have asked you this last time a little bit, but now it's more a, I guess even a few years later, it's become more of a more commonplace and more of a set template for people playing on each other's albums. It's like what everyone's doing now, you know, like you've got George Lynch, who's in so many bands and guys like that. So for those of us outside the industry, how does the template work? Like, how do you actually approach? So I know these guys played on your first album, so you've got a personal relationship, but how does it actually work? I guess from a business sense, without talking dollars, how does it work when you want someone to play on your record, or when someone like Michael Sweet wants you to play on their record? Is every situation different, or are there procedures that everyone goes through now and conventions that everyone goes through?
Oh, I mean, you pretty much send somebody an email or text and say, hey, you up for this? Hey, what's your schedule looking like? That type of stuff. And are you free to do it? And so thankfully the whole lineup came back for this one. And this is obviously my thing, so that's the way it works. I ask if they'll be willing to play on mine, and in the case of Michael Sweet asking me to play on his, he's contacting me. So and then you usually just send a stereo mix of a track, more than a full session. Typically you'll just get like here's the state of the track right now, and you lay down your tracks and make sure that they're in Pro Tools. You do it so they're consolidated to the same length, so you send them and they drop right into the person's session, and there you go. That's pretty much the way it works. That's the Reader's Digest version.
Because it's refreshing to actually hear that it still works person to person. I mean, you know, back in the day when people had these restrictive record contracts, like the guys on Fastway, who formed the band Fastway, couldn't play on their own record because they had, you know, because they had contracts with other record companies and they couldn't get out of them and they weren't allowed to perform on other people's records. So it's good to hear that it's not that restrictive anymore. I guess the record, that's maybe one of the few positives of the industry becoming not as all powerful as it used to be.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I certainly enjoy being able to work with other musicians and have that freedom. I think that's it. I mean, it's essential these days. I don't really know anybody doing like one thing. Or not many. I mean, typically people are part of 2-3 things these days, at the very least. It's just very hard to find something that can occupy 12 months out of your year. So even if you're in a band that's doing well, let's say you tour 5 months that year, 6 months, you get, what are you supposed to do with the other 6 months?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, so I think that it's just that's the state of the music industry these days. So, you know, people back, they tend to complain about that these days, but I think a few years ago they could see this and they'd go, oh, I'd do anything to be able to hear George Lynch play with so-and-so, right? Yeah, or that kind of thing. Yeah. So I think it's funny how people always they find a way to complain about these things when now, I mean, now I think nowadays it is what it is, of course, that people do work together and collaborate. And I mean, I think it's cool myself, but I'm a musician, so I look at it differently than like the standard fan.
I guess
there's an illusion of the fans that like the bands are all like living together in a house and are all like, you know, it's us against the world kind of thing. But I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's just not really the way it is.
I guess the one thing is that fans become suspicious of is that if the quality suffers, you know, if you're involved in six different projects and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't, that's the fear, I guess, of a fan, is that their favorite musician will get involved in so many projects and they'll feel that the quality will be diluted. Is that a realistic concern, or is that not realistic?
I'd say that's not realistic. I mean, I would never... I would never phone in an effort on anything I'm doing ever. So at least from my perspective, I would never do that. So, I mean, it's all part of your body of work that you're putting out there to the world. So I think most musicians I know would not do that. Everybody's always going to put in their best effort on things. I mean, as far as I know, maybe there's some very jaded people out there. I don't know, but I would never do that. I mean, I look at it like you're putting out something that's going to define your career or your body of work. So you always want it to be the very best it can be.
Yeah. Let's have another song. Joel, what can we play for the listeners? What can we play?
Yeah, let's do Finish Line then.
Ooh, I got a white line fever. Going to run land down under. Going to turn around the corner way down yonder. And I'm not even going to try to rhyme anymore. Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever. And you get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever. Rock like fuck. That's what I say. Okay, come on down and rock on.